from the heart of the Forest City, this is a Craig Needles podcast brought to you by Lexus of London. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It is the Craig Needles podcast, and of course, we are brought to you by our friends over at Lexus of London. You can find us at classicrock981.com and londonnewstoday.ca. We are talking about the biggest story of the week here in the province of Ontario, which is, of course, the fact that your kids are not in school today. And, well, for the most part, there are some places where they are, where QP does not represent the workers who are on the school support staff. But the point is, for the most part, your kids are not in school today. And I'm wondering why. And I'm wondering how long this may last. And to give us some analysis here is someone who knows the goings on at Queen's Park because she used to work there. Suze Morrison, the former MPP for Toronto Centre, joining us here on the Craig Needles podcast to have a chat about that. Hello, Suze. Thank you for doing this.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So my first question for you is, do you think that the premier is going to have the stomach for this a whole lot longer? Because I don't think this is going the way that they had anticipated when they brought in the notwithstanding clause. I think that they were of the belief they're going to be hailed as heroes by parents who kept kids in class. And as I look at the situation in the province right now, that's not the way things are going. How do you think this proceeds?
Yeah, I don't think this is going down the way that Ford and Lecce anticipated. And I think it's because at the end of the day, parents and families are looking at the situation and they're seeing that what Ford and Lecce are doing are actually hurting kids in the long term. When we have a sector of workers who are the lowest paid public workers in this province, that are being absolutely disrespected by their government. I think it's clear to parents that what Ford and Lecce are doing is setting the stage to start driving education workers out of the sector en masse. And it's exactly what's happened in healthcare. It's not difficult to find, hospitals that are struggling to keep wards and emergency departments staffed with nurses and PSWs because the workers, again, are so underpaid and so disrespected, they've started moving on to work in other sectors because it gets to a point where it's just an unlivable situation. And our education workers work so hard and they're in it for the kids, not for the money. And all they're saying is, we want a fair wage. We don't want to have to rely on food banks to feed ourselves as publicly paid employees. And I think that, parents are looking at this and saying, this is going to hurt my kids in the long run when there are no people willing to work in the sector to take care of my kids in the school.
And here's the thing with the premier is he wants to be liked. He wants people to like him and he wants to be seen as the nice, friendly premier, which is fine. But this is really going against the brand when A, kids are out of school, and B, we were just talking about it before we started recording, when there's platforms like Breakfast Television where Sid Sixero is just tearing a strip off the guy in front of thousands of Toronto voters who will be watching that particular program. Like, that's just not, I just don't know if he's going to have the stomach for this for very much longer.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And, I saw that clip and I think, anyone that's listening that hasn't seen it should definitely wander over to Twitter and check that out from the Breakfast Television clip. And he did absolutely just eviscerate Ford and Lecce in that statement. And to come from, a program that, veers more on the side of entertainment, right? I think it shows just how big this is and how poorly Ford and Lecce have hit the mark on this. People are outraged. People are absolutely outraged. And not just people that work in the education sector, right? What we're seeing is a lot of solidarity. I just came from Queen's Park. I was there all morning as part of the protest. And it's not just QP workers that are there. It is, the ATU Transit Local was there, the Ontario Federation of Labor, the OFL was there, some of the teachers' unions were represented, the electrical workers were there, the IEBW electrical workers. It's the solidarity is immense, and I think rightfully so, because I think, the other piece of this that, I think, is important to note is that the use of the notwithstanding clause in this instance is an absolute infringement on the charter rights of workers to strike and to organize. You can't just willy-nilly throw charter rights out with the bathwater in a temper tantrum. Every worker in this province should have goosebumps and be very afraid, because if they can do this to education workers, they can do it to any unionized worker in this province and across Canada. It's a terrifying precedent.
Yeah, it really is. It just is. And here's the thing. If you want to treat education workers and teachers as essential workers, you're going to have to put them on the same plan as firefighters and police officers, where they can't strike. But binding arbitration is the way that this ends if you can't find a deal. You're going to have to do that as opposed to using the notwithstanding clause. And you're going to have a collective understanding, not necessarily an agreement, but understanding that, okay, you're an essential service now, and therefore you're on the same plan as the OPP. You're on the same plan as, you know, pick a police service around the province, pick a fire department around the province. And if you are someone who is in QP, one of these 55,000 workers, that actually would sound like a pretty good deal to you, because the firefighters and police officers have been doing the hell of a lot better than you have raises-wise over the last decade. So that's, if you don't want them to have the right to strike anymore, if keeping kids in class is really what this is important about, and you want to say that's an essential service, fine. You have to treat them like an essential service, and that's not what the government's doing here.
No, and that means you have to respect them like an essential service and pay them like an essential service. You know, I keep thinking about the fact that, you know, It should be outrageous. It should be the scandal of the decade that there is a single public paid employee in this province that is forced to use a food bank.
Yeah, it's brutal.
A scandal in and of itself, that we have publicly paid employees that are paid with our tax dollars that are so underpaid they are forced to use food banks to survive.
Yeah. I couldn't believe that either. And here's the other part of this is, I've got a lot of people in my mentions. I've had a couple of tweets that have gone a little viral about this over the last few days. And I got all these people mentions, well, if these early childhood educators or these educational assistants don't like it, they should go do some other job. Do we really want to have the conditions of work in the province of Ontario for jobs like that one to be that people don't want to do them anymore? Is that what we really should be trying to design here? Because I want the ECE in my daughter's class to be someone who is really good at it. And my daughter has a wonderful ECE in her class who my daughter absolutely adores. Do I want that person to not work there anymore? No, that sounds bad for me, because I want my daughter to have a positive school environment.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And at the end of the day, it's going to be the kids that suffer when these workers, reach a point where it's unsustainable. I mean, you know, when you look historically at the raises that this sector has received for the last decade, we're talking about most years at 0%. A couple years they get, you know, 0.5%. There's, I think, one or two years in there they got 1%. 1 year at 1.5. And, you know, think about over the last 10 years, what was the price of rent in places like Toronto and London 10 years ago? What was, how much food could you get for $100 at the grocery store 10 years ago?
A lot more than today.
Right. And so you think about that, this history of underpayment for the work, underappreciation for the work, the skyrocketing rate of inflation, which has only gotten worse over the last year, the skyrocketing cost of rent, cost of food, cost of everything. And how are these workers supposed to keep food on their tables? How are they supposed to pay the rent? And they will reach a breaking point, as all workers do, where they will have to move on to other things because they have families themselves that they have to provide for. And what Ford is doing is saying, he's effectively pushing these workers out of the sector the same way he has with nurses and PSWs. We have a healthcare human resources crisis happening right now. And if this keeps up, if these legislated poverty wages continue, these workers will start leaving the sector en masse. And I can't underscore that enough. And it's the kids that will suffer when these jobs go unfilled and there is no one in those classrooms to support those kids, and our schools can't operate effectively.
So let's talk about this, how this sort of moves through the political system. So at Queen's Park right now, obviously the Progressive Conservatives have a majority. So there's only so much the opposition can do. What do you do in situations like this when you're on the opposition bench and you're unhappy with something the government is doing? How does that work?
Yeah, there unfortunately is not a whole lot that the opposition can do. I think an important thing to note is that, Ford has actually spent the last 4 years rewriting the very rules of the legislature. So the rules of the House are called the standing orders, and they've rewritten them, I think, more than any sitting government in recent history. They changed sort of the minor innocent looking things. They'll change the schedule of the day. There was the time they introduced a package of changes that included introducing God Save the Queen. And that was really just a deflection. They did that so the story was about God Save the Queen, not about all of the other procedural changes that they were making that were actually quite terrible. All of these things. But what it's effectively allowed them to do is to pass a bill in a week. You can table a bill on Monday morning and have it be law by Thursday afternoon. And it didn't used to be possible by the standing orders. All of the rules that say this is how a bill moves through the House. It didn't used to be possible to pass a bill in 4 days. Every time as an opposition, we've found some sort of effective tool to delay them, to stall them. They'll come back, after the dust has settled, and they just rewrite the rules so we can't do that thing anymore. I think a really good example, and this is going to get kind of procedural. And
that's okay.
But I find it interesting. A really good example is when we did the zebra mussel bills. So back during in 2018, when Bill 5, which was the bill that cut Toronto City Council in half in the middle of an election, was tabled. And if folks will remember, that was actually when they retabled that bill. That was the first time they retabled it that was the first time they used the notwithstanding clause. It was back in 2018. And we can't filibuster to delay bills like they can in the States, right? Where someone stands up and takes the floor and doesn't stop speaking for a very, very long time as a way of sort of blocking a bill from moving through the House, right? If you never see the floor, never sit down. You can't stand for more than a certain amount of time. Like, there's rules around that. They'll shut off your mic. You'll get kicked out of the House. We can't do filibusters. But at the time, there wasn't a limit on how long it could take in the day to introduce new bills. So if we stood there and never stopped introducing new bills, we could eat into the time in the agenda as a way of sort of like delaying and stalling. And so we started introducing all of these really long bills about zebra mussels, where the title of each bill, because it named every single waterway in the whole province, like every river, pond, lake, stream, and called on the legislature, the title of the bill basically called on the legislature to study the zebra mussels in all of these waterways. And the bill itself was, like it was a motion. It was like 2 pages. It took us so long to read all of these bills. So if you look in 2018, there's like 100 bills on the order paper from early in that session, all about zebra mussels. And we thought we were so clever at the time. It was a delay tactic that let us also buy a couple of days doing that for people to organize around that bill so that people could actually have time to plan protests, plan letter writing campaigns, like to actually get organized to try and show opposition, right? Ford came back and they changed the rules of the standing order that says, if introduction of new bills takes more than a certain amount of time, it just eats into the time for the debate. The debate can be shortened at that point based on that. So it basically took even that basic, just tiny, tiny delay tactic. When you look at these rules of this place, it all looks really innocent, just changes to the agenda, the timing of the day. But it takes away any power for the opposition to meaningfully delay or stall or create space for the public to engage with a bill in a meaningful way. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, if they come back and start changing the standing orders again after this, you know, when the opposition have found the next creative way to sort of try to stall or delay or stop a bill. But it's technical, it's hard to follow, but it's truly disgusting.
Yeah, it's not what you want. And I just, and here's the thing. I'm not saying that every single thing this government does is bad and I disagree with it. And every single thing the opposition wants to do is good. I'm not going to sit and tell anyone that. But what I am saying is, hey, let's have it so we can have fulsome conversation about this stuff. And that's not what's going on there. I did notice that some of your former colleagues decided to get ejected from the legislature earlier this week because they are not happy about this particular bill. I have to ask you, what happens when you get ejected from the legislature? Because I know you have been before.
I have been ejected once.
Okay.
And it was over Bill 5, actually, back when they cut Toronto City Council in half. And again, as an opposition, when you have so few tools at your disposal, protest becomes a really powerful one. And for a member to protest in the chamber to the point that you're removed sends a really powerful signal. And we don't do it often, right? It's because it sort of loses the power of the statement if it's something you do frequently. Because you do lose your privileges and rights to access the chamber for a full day. So it means if you're scheduled to debate a bill that afternoon, you can't come back into the chamber and debate. And you have to find one of your colleagues to maybe cover off on something you were responsible for that day. If you were scheduled to give a member statement, you lose your member statement. You don't get that back. You give up your right to be in your seat to have a voice in that house for the day. So we don't use it very often because you don't abuse something that is intended to be a powerful statement of protest. So anytime a member is removed in protest from the legislature, it means something very, very, very big, because a legislator may only do that once in a term, right? Yeah. Like that's how big of a deal that is. You are formally removed by the sergeant at arms. She comes and marches you out of the chamber. It's a little bit dramatic.
Yeah. She throws you out like you're Jazz and she's Uncle Phil. Like,
they literally come and remove you. At that point you have to be smart. Like you can't sort of resist being removed or, you know, the consequences can get quite significant after that. You can be banned from the whole property for I think a week or a month or something like that. Like there is an escalation and it's quite significant. I really hope that the public takes that statement with the seriousness of what it is. But you know, as members, when we say, you know, like what is happening is so outrageous and the tools of this house are so inadequate to fight this, all we have left is this powerful statement of protest. I really hope that, you know, the public recognizes what a significant act that is for those members to do.
Yeah, I would also hope that. There was, I know Terrence Kernahan was thrown out locally here, Catherine Fife, Peter Dobbins. It was a pretty lengthy list. There was a lot of desk pounding and the like. So before we wrap up, Suze, I'll ask you, do you think that this is something that could hypothetically drag on? Like, do you envision a scenario where kids are not back in school by the end of next week, or do you think that this gets settled pretty quickly? I'll ask you to use the crystal ball a little bit.
I don't know. I mean, anything I say is sort of speculation. Like you said, kind of looking into the crystal ball. I think that I don't see either side willing to back down on this easily. I think, like I said, education workers have been pushed too far. And they're not asking for a lot. They're asking to be paid well enough to not have to use food banks. And, I don't see either side backing down. I think this is actually about to get bigger. I think that other unions are looking at this and saying, if we don't stand up for these workers, we're next. Like, what is the precedent here for our workers? And I think that, you know, while this strike has been technically legislated as illegal, I think people need to remember that At one point, any strike in this country wasn't legal. And the right to strike, the right of workers, any right of workers, was never freely given. Workers had to illegally strike to earn every single right we have as workers. And there's some pretty big ones in there. Maternity leave, paternity leave is one of them. Workers had to strike for that. And that was a long one that dragged on while those workers fought for paternity leave. And, you know, I see a lot of solidarity about to come down. And I think this is about to get bigger than Ford and Lecce envisioned. And I hope they realize it didn't have to be this way. They could have come to the table and bargained in good faith and said, you know what, maybe it's a policy failure of provincial governments of all stripes and colors going back 10, 15, 20 years that we have publicly paid workers in this province using food banks.
Yeah.
And maybe we can pay you more. And you know, it didn't have to come down to this. They could have said maybe $39,000 a year isn't enough to live on.
Right. And you know, that was something that was in my mentions too. Like, oh, if you're mad that these workers aren't paid, you should blame Dalton McGuinty and Kathleen Wynne. I'm like, yeah, okay.
Let's please do that.
Yeah,
you know, the Liberals had just as good of a hand in this as Ford.
I've got no problem doing that, but that's, I don't think like, and I'm, you know, you're a New Democrat, but at some point, like, you know, you don't have, like, I get frustrated by saying, oh, you don't like Doug Ford, you must love Justin Trudeau. Like, not necessarily. Like, you know, like,
it's not a binary.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and I made no, I voted Green last provincial election just because I thought they had a good candidate, good plan, all that stuff. So yeah, you can, there's all sorts of different parties you can vote for where you don't like what the red one or the blue one. It's an option. So yeah,
That's just it, right?
Yeah.
I don't think that they realize what they've bitten off here. I think that workers are about to come out in solidarity in a big way. You know, folks were chanting about general strikes today at Queen's Park. And I think that unions are starting to meet with their members and their leadership across this province to say, how do we support these workers? Because, you know, if you're going to take away the constitutionally protected rights of one class of workers, no one is safe.
Yeah,
no one is safe.
Yeah, that's the part that I think is gonna stick for a lot of people. And I just, you know, that if in this is kind of bad luck for CUPE, but if their contract ended a year ago, the government would never have pulled this.
Oh no, right?
No,
like, they have
chance.
The luxury of knowing that they are in the first year of a 4-year majority tour.
3 years from now, people, not everyone, but people are gonna forget about this, especially if it ends in the next week.
Yeah, it is the common playbook of any government to do the most unpopular things early in their terms. They have 2 years to dig themselves out and buy themselves back into popularity. Why do you think Bill 5 was the very first thing Doug Ford did in 2018?
Well, because he had to cut it off before that election even occurred, even though nominations had already begun. But same deal.
Right. Yep. And it was declared unconstitutional. And then they retabled the bill with the notwithstanding clause. So, you know, it's they learned early in 2018 how to, do what they wanted to do. People's human rights be damned. They've done it several times. You know, they've used the notwithstanding clause more than I think any sitting provincial government in history.
I believe within Ontario, it hadn't been used until Doug Ford had been elected.
Yeah.
So now they've either used it or attempted to use it because they didn't wind up using it every time. But this is the third either usage or attempted usage.
Yep.
So.
And in 4 years, like that should be terrifying. You know, anytime you're willing to set aside the human rights code to enact your legislation should send like shivers down the spine of every person in this province. You know, and so I guess my call to action to anyone that's listening is, you know, go stand in solidarity with your education workers. If you don't know what to do with your kids while the strikes are happening, take your kids to the picket line. My mom used to take me to picket lines when my teachers were on strike. You know, back when I was in, I think, the third or fourth grade, we had a big, long strike. We sat on that picket line every single day. You will learn on the picket line. Teach your kids, use it as an opportunity to teach your kids about labor history and why solidarity with the labor movement is so important. You know, if you're a worker, if you're part of a union, talk to your union leadership about how you show solidarity in this moment, because, you know, solidarity forever doesn't just mean sometimes, right? I think there's a lot that the people of this province, you know, whether you're a unionized worker, a parent, a student, or any worker that we can be doing to show solidarity and support for our education workers. So I guess I'd just like to really encourage folks to think about what you can be doing over the next few days to support those people, because this is one of those moments in Ontario history that has to be bigger than, you know, any one class of worker, any one union, any one strike. This is really a historic moment, and I hope people are willing to meet it and engage with it as the historic moment that it is.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens here. We're going to talk a little bit about notwithstanding clause with the folks from Canadian Civil Liberties Association coming up. But Suze, thank you so much for doing this, for providing your insight as always. Really appreciative.
Happy to.
That's Suze Morrison, who, of course, is the former member of Provincial Parliament for Toronto Centre and joined us here on the Craig Needles podcast to have a conversation about what's going on at Queen's Park and Ontario-wide right now with this QP strike, 55,000 workers off the job. We'll see what happens next. But as of this recording, they are still off the job. We're going to take a quick break here because I want to switch gears and same story, but different angle to it. I want to talk about the notwithstanding clause. Going to visit that with the folks at the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. But first, want to remind you that the Craig Needles podcast is brought to you by Lexus of London. Lifestyle with a drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at the award-winning Lexus of London. Luxury defined. You can choose yours today at Lexus of London. You can find them at 1060. 65 Warrencliffe Road South and online at lexusoflondon.com. And we continue on this episode of the Craig Needles podcast, focusing on what's going on with 55,000 QP education workers who are off the job right now. And I want to talk about this with the folks over at the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. And Andrew Loken is the chair of the board there. And I wanted to ask about their take on what's gone on with the use of the notwithstanding clause and whether we need a notwithstanding clause in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. They've done some releases about this. So I'm glad that Andrew is able to spend a few minutes with us to talk about today. Andrew, thank you so much for doing this. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So the notwithstanding clause right now is being used as a very, very blunt instrument against 55,000 school support staff workers, essentially saying to them, this is the contract you have now. No, you cannot strike, even though they're striking anyway, but this is the contract you have now. Negotiations are over. What was the Canadian Civil Liberties Association reaction to that move from the Ford government?
Well, we think it's a sad day for democracy. The use of the notwithstanding clause, and this is not particular to the present government, it's becoming a bit of a trend with other governments as well. It was originally foreseen as something that might be rare and exceptional, but it's really becoming normalized now. And you have to ask, what's the point of having a charter if all the key rights in the charter can be overridden by a government whenever the government finds it politically expedient to do so?
Yeah, that's the part that I have a problem with here is Ontario governments went for a very long time without using the notwithstanding clause. And now all of a sudden, to borrow, like Doug Ford is handing it out like candy at Halloween. Like it just seems like every couple of months we're going to bust out the notwithstanding clause. That was not what the notwithstanding clause was designed for. It's not what it should be used for. And I think it's getting ridiculous that we're doing this so frequently.
Well, in the case of the present provincial government, this is the second time they've used it outright. There was a third time when they threatened to use it, but as a result of a change in a court ruling, they didn't need to follow through on that threat. But the concern is very much that it's just becoming something that it's too easy for governments to do. And you have to question, what's the point of having the notwithstanding clause in the charter? It was put in there in 1982 when a couple of premiers thought that they would like to have the last word on matters of constitutional rights, on these fundamental rights and freedoms. It was controversial then, but I don't think even back then anyone imagined that it would be something that could be used when really government has plenty of alternatives.
The government does have alternatives, including negotiating, including binding arbitration. There's all sorts of different things they could have done. They could hypothetically declare all education workers essential services like they have done with police officers and firefighters and just settle all of these labor disputes they may have with those unions in the same way they settle those ones, which, again, some people may argue is not a great system. And I don't think it's a great system either, but it's a hell of a lot better than using the notwithstanding clause whenever it's not going the way you want.
I'm going to agree with you on that. I'm not sure I can agree that they could declare everybody to be essential workers, but they certainly could have used binding arbitration. The Supreme Yep. Court has set out a roadmap for what you need to do when you want to avoid a strike and provide a constitutionally compliant alternative, something that measures up to the charter, and that's binding arbitration with a fair and neutral arbitrator. The present government did not take that route.
No, they did not. And that's the thing. And look, I'm not saying, hey, we should declare every education union worker essential tomorrow. I'm not saying that's the right way to go, but I think it's better than what we've done if we're picking different ways. Let's talk about the fact that the notwithstanding clause is in the charter at all, which, of course, was put there in 1982. Do we need to remove it? Because if the Ford government's going to use it as regularly as they have, and it's used in Quebec far too regularly as well, have we got to the point where that clause, and I know this is complicated, we're talking about taking stuff in and out of the charter and the Constitution, I get it, but is that clause dated here in 2022 in your estimation?
The Canadian Civil Liberties Association has called for the clause to be repealed. It does more harm than good. I'm not sure that it was ever needed, but certainly we can say at this point it's something which has to go. It's not easy to remove it. It would require an amendment on the so-called 7-50 formula. You'd need seven provinces with 50% of the population, as well as the federal government, to agree. But, you know, I don't think most Canadians are aware that this clause is there, or weren't until recently, with its ability to override all of these most important rights: freedom of religion, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly and association, the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, equality. All of those rights in the Charter are subject to being overridden by the government. And I think as Canadians become more and more conscious of that fact, they'll be ready to call upon their governments to do something about it.
And you mentioned sort of the way that clause could be removed from the Charter and from the Constitution. And it doesn't take a math wizard to look at, hey, wait, if Ontario doesn't want to do this and Quebec doesn't want to do this, well, that's 22 million people right there. We're not going to get to seven provinces and 50% of the population if Ontario and Quebec are out on it, right?
That's the current demographics. But, you know, governments change.
That's true.
Sometimes public opinion evolves. And I would like to think that it's something that it's achievable before too long.
I hope so, too. And I would really love to see that, because, again, it just is. It's why is it there? Why do we even have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms if there's a little bullet point at the end of it that says, oh, by the way, we can take whatever one of these away from you at any time we want without actually justifying it?
And Craig, you're absolutely right. The American Constitution doesn't have any such thing. There are plenty of checks and balances already in the Canadian Charter. Plenty of things that governments can argue if they believe that their laws are just and reasonable. They don't need this power. Canadians don't need them to have this power, and we'd be better off without it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So I guess the message from the Canadian Civil Liberties Association is just sort of increase advocacy on this and tell your elected representatives that, hey, we don't want that to be in there anymore.
And you know, short of an amendment to take it out, the other thing governments could do is pledge not to use it.
Right.
The federal government has never used it. And if other governments start saying, you know, we know public opinion is against this, we know that this is trampling people's rights, we are not going to use it, we're going to exercise self-restraint on this, then after a while that starts to count too.
And make it a political issue at election time as well, I would think, is, you know, when you're electing a government, say, hey, would your government ever use the notwithstanding clause? And if they say no, then you have to hold them to that.
Absolutely. This is something where ultimately it's the Canadian people have the final say, and Canadians should be delivering the message loud and clear to their governments, whether provincial or federal. They don't want this loophole in the charter. They don't want the government to be able to nullify their rights. Charter is very popular amongst Canadians. It has always been popular across the country. And it's time to get rid of this loophole.
Yeah, I would agree with that entirely. Andrew, that's all the questions I had about this and about what's going on with QP. Is there anything else that you wanted to add or make sure folks know about on this discussion before we wrap up here?
The only thing I'd say is that anyone who feels minded to do so, they can contact their local MPP and just register their concern and their displeasure at this trampling of democratic rights.
Yeah, I just think it's unacceptable. Like it's just the like I said, the most blunt instrument you could possibly use against workers who are really low paid and it shouldn't be used against anybody. And that's the frustrating part of it. Andrew, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate that you could take a couple of minutes and give us some time.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
That is Andrew Loken, who, of course, is the chair of the board over the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, and they're right. And before anyone sends me a message to talk about trampled rights and whatever it happens to be, and hey, Craig, where were you when the convoy people had their rights trampled? Well, I can tell you that I and the Canadian Civil Liberties Association had the same position on that. And that position was the Emergencies Act was government overreach and shouldn't have been used, and I think that we're finding that out at this inquiry into the use of the Emergency Act. That doesn't mean the convoy people were not jerks. They were. That doesn't mean the convoy people should not have been removed from the streets of Ottawa far sooner than they actually were. That is absolutely the case. But should the Emergency Act have been used against them? No. So I don't think that argument really holds a lot of water, especially in the case of me and the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, because we are of the belief that that should not have been used against the convoy people. So there's that. As for what happens next, I don't know. I don't know what the weekend looks like. I have no idea what Monday looks like. I hope that my daughter has a school to go to on Monday, but I guess we're going to see. I guess we're going to have to wait and figure that out. Until then, thank you very much for listening to this edition of the Craig Needles Podcast. Was going to be roundtable today, but just had to move around the schedule a little bit. Had a lot of stuff going on, but I appreciate you downloading and listening to this edition of the Craig Needles Podcast. Had fun putting it together. We will talk to you next week on this very podcast, which is brought to you by Lexus of London, Lifestyle with a Draw. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at the award-winning Lexus of London, 1065 Warrencliffe Road South, and online at lexusoflondon.com. Luxury defined. Choose yours today at Lexus of London. Again, 1065 Warrencliffe Road South and online at lexusoflondon.com.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.